This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Thanks to the former South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford, hiking the Appalachian Trail is now a euphemism for philandering or making up a zany excuse. That's what his staff said he was doing when he disappeared from contact for 6 days in June of 2009. In reality, Sanford was visiting his mistress, Maria Belén Chapur, in Argentina. It was easy to feel sorry for Jenny Sanford, who was humiliated by her husband's declaration that in Chapur he'd found his soulmate. Also wounded was Sanford's hard-working and mortified staff, Barton Swaim among them. Swaim worked as a writer for the disgraced governor, who'd once been considered a strong presidential contender. Swaim's book, The Speechwriter, gives us an intimate look at the messy, unpredictable, frequently absurd world of the contemporary political spin room. And Barton Swaim, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, soon after coming on board in Governor Mark Sanford's office, you realized you were not hired to write brilliant prose. You had to write loads of letters to constituents, talking points for speeches, and surrogate letters. Now, these are letters to the editor, ostensibly from supporters, but actually written by the governor's staff. Really?
Yes.
I mean, do all politicians do that?
I don't know. I should ask around, but it sounded to me like it was a pretty common thing. It may have had, though, to do with the fact that the governor thought that letters to the editor were important. Now, I don't know if he's wrong about that, because most of us, when we read most letters to the editor, we think it's kind of a poor expression of, unless it's in the Wall Street Journal or something, but if it's in a local paper, you know, they usually seem sort of off balance or angry or something. But he was convinced that any spontaneous expression from an average citizen in print, you know, favorable to him, was a net plus and it was powerful in its way. And he might be right about that. I don't know. But the trouble is you couldn't get his supporters to write the letters. You'd call them and you'd say, hey, you know, the governor said such and such. I know you care about that issue. Would you mind writing a letter to the editor? And they'd say, sure. But then they wouldn't do it, or then they wouldn't. You couldn't conjure it up. So somebody along the line had the idea of just writing it for them and you know, emailing it to them. And they'd send it in, which worked a lot of times. So part of my job occasionally, especially if it was a really contentious issue, was to write, you know, 20 or so of these dreadful things. And it was really hard. It sounds mindless, but it's very engaging in a horrible kind of way, because you had to make them sound like, you know, spontaneous and not what they were, which was calculating attempts to push a certain viewpoint.
So you didn't actually make up names. You sent them to constituents and they signed them.
Yeah, right. I think a lot of people probably do make up names, and editors won't run them. Nowadays, anyway, they'll call you or try to verify that you exist before they run it.
Well, this is one of those glimpses of what goes on inside of the political machine that I found so illuminating. And of course, there is a very different public persona for the governor than that of his interactions with his staff when nobody was looking. What kind of boss was he?
He was one of those bosses whose leadership style or managerial style is to express extreme dissatisfaction with everything anyone does in the hopes that you'll do it better, which kind of works, actually. You do want to do it better so that it doesn't happen again. And he would not mind, you know, sort of berating you in front of other staffers. It was so bad, though, that it was almost comical, in a sort of macabre sort of way. And it happened to everyone. It wasn't personal. You know, it would happen to the chief of staff right on down. And so in a weird sense, it created a kind of camaraderie. And as soon as he walked out of the room, everybody would sort of rate that one. That one was bad, but it wasn't as bad as such and such episode. If you didn't leave crying after the first, you know, couple of months, then you could stick it out.
Well, a lot of people he reduced to tears. He never accepted a document without first saying it was worthless. He was belittling. And there's one extreme show of insensitivity involving a birthday cake for one of your colleagues. What happened there?
Well, if you or I walked past a, you know, in an office setting, walked past someone's birthday cake and it had not been cut and the candles in it were unlit, we would think, probably shouldn't cut myself a piece. But the governor is a sort of different sort of person. And some people even think this is there's some kind of condition that you could diagnose. I don't know. But he did. It said happy birthday on it, and it was to one of the staffers, and he looked at it and mumbled, "I'll eat this tonight," cut himself a piece, put it on a plate, and walked into his office and shut the door. Now, the crazy thing about that, and this isn't in the book, is that the staffer that happened to,
I can't remember.
Yeah, I called her June in the book. She did not remember that, and I think it's because it was that normal to her.
The book reads a little bit like an episode of Veep gone wrong. I mean, the guy is kind of he's always rambling, always demanding, you know, get me something on the X, you know, information. Yeah. But you say he wasn't malicious. Well, why do you say not malicious?
He was brutal in getting the thing that he wanted. But as soon as the episode was over, it was as if it never happened. And he wouldn't remember it, you know, later. He's not a vindictive guy. It's just the way he ran the office, and you knew this, and somehow, it didn't make it okay, but it made it at least tolerable.
We're getting a glimpse of the inner workings of a modern political office or spin room with Barton Swain. He worked as a speechwriter for the disgraced governor, who was once considered a strong presidential contender, Mark Sanford. His new book is called The Speechwriter. Well, Barton, you know, despite the treatment of the staff, they believed he was pretty much incorruptible. And your book almost reads like a, I don't know, a movie or a mystery setup. You know, the person that you least suspect to be behaving badly was behaving badly.
Right.
So what was happening inside of the State House when he went missing for those days in June? He gave the slip to his security detail. Nobody knew where he was.
Yeah, and this often happened. He's the sort of person who likes to go off on his own. And, of course, like anybody else, he would take vacations. And I liked it when he took vacations, which you can see why. And so when media started saying, where's the governor? And we couldn't get a straightforward answer out of, you know, senior staff. It seemed okay to me. I didn't, you know, if the governor of South Carolina is missing, it's not that big of a deal, I didn't think. And so I thought that it was just sort of classic slow news day stuff. Even the day of the press conference that morning, I still thought it was sort of an overblown thing and, you know, okay, so he went on the Appalachian Trail and couldn't be found. Who cares? He's a weird guy. You know, welcome to my world. Until a deputy chief of staff came in, the person I called June, and she said the governor is going to say something that will be disappointing. And her eyes were red. So that made my heart sink. And the thing about Sanford to me then was that although I did not like him as a person, I mean you couldn't like him if you worked for him personally. Although I didn't like him, I did admire him, and I thought that he had a kind of self-control, and he behaved like an adult, as I thought. Especially as compared to, say, the lieutenant governor and others who were always, you know, up to some crazy shenanigan. He was the last person I would ever have envisioned doing anything like that. I mean, he's not one of those flirty politicians. And when it does happen, you think, well, I could kind of see that. Not at all. In fact, you know, with men and women, when a conversation would turn towards something even vaguely personal, he would immediately change the topic. And so for this to happen was sort of mind-blowing for me and for everybody else. We didn't even know what to think I mean, it sounds like a cliche probably from a novel or something, but for 2 or 3 days you'd wake up and you think, I had this dumb dream. Oh, wait.
Well, what happened in reality was a reporter working on a tip-off met him at the airport at 5:43 in the morning when he came in from Buenos Aires. Now, you did not write the governor's speech for a hastily called press conference when this whole ruse was discovered. But how about to the staff? How did he apologize to you?
The staff was called together, about 20 of us or so, and the governor was coming, and it was said that he was going to apologize to us. And it seemed in that meeting, which was very weird, it seemed like he wanted to say that he was sorry in some kind of genuine or unqualified way, but it just wouldn't come out. And instead, some very weird things came out about, well, at least, you know, we're not living in a concentration camp, and the sun did actually come up today. And that was it, and it was over.
Well, it's true. You weren't living in a concentration camp.
That's true. That was absolutely true. But as one of my colleagues noted afterwards, while that is true, it probably shouldn't be the governor saying that.
Right. Well, he did. He resigned as the chair of the Republican Governors Association. He survived impeachment hearings, paid back taxpayer money used for the trip. For the staff who'd been badgered and demeaned for so long, was there any, I don't know, sense of like, well, good, he got his comeuppance?
It was a weird dynamic set in psychologically, at least for me, and I think for a few others. After the scandal, a lot of our work necessarily involved protecting a disgraced politician, which is never a thing that you want to do or that you think that you're going to do when you go into a job like this. But strangely, if there was anything that we disliked more than the governor, it was his fiercest enemies in the legislature. Among them, Jakey Knotts, whom I've rendered accurately, though comically, in the book, a kind of vicious buffoon and a racist who's now been defeated and has presumably a job in the private sector. We hated those guys, and they were after him. They knew that they were going to get him thrown out of office. And so in that way, we were able to perform at a higher level than we would have thought possible for this disgraced politician that we couldn't stand anyway.
One of the things I was thinking while reading this book is the whole nature of speech writing. It is theater. You know, the thought of quoting someone else without attribution, you know, that's a hanging offense in politics. Right. But employing someone to make up words that present you as a smarter, more knowledgeable version of yourself is okay. I mean, is speech writing an honest profession?
Right. I have divided feelings about it. On one hand, it's just impossible for a modern politician who is expected to speak in some way on just scores of things, many of which he doesn't even care about, every day, or, you know, certainly every week, statements to the media, just remarks to whatever group wants to say hello in the office, who knows. It's just impossible to say that many things and know and have any idea who you're talking to and to have something at least quasi-intelligent to say for each particular audience. And you do need some help, you know, just getting it straight. And for a lot of politicians, I think they don't just get up and parrot the things that they were told to say. They actually think through and edit and so forth. On the other hand, though, I read recently that Warren Harding was the first president to use a speechwriter, and it seems remarkable to me now to think that at one time we had presidents who were not surrounded by a team of communications professionals, and the words that came out of, say, the White House or a governor's office would not be the product of a team of speechwriters and wouldn't have been vetted by all sorts of you know, communication staffers and policy staffers and so on. It would just be what the president or the governor wanted to say. And so as a result, I think it's hard to even know on at least some topics what the politician in the middle of that circle, what he really thinks about anything.
Martin Swain, thank you for this insider's view. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Martin Swain is a freelance writer who's contributed to The Wall Street Journal, among other places. His book is called The Speechwriter. You can find more on the book at wordofmouthradio.org.